being able to draw drawings is slightly different to being able to read drawings well and actually interpret someone's design. And I think a large part of what's accelerated my career is kind of the design and build aspect in the industry and the way things are changing. That, you know, the traditional way of it going step by step passed over to the contractor after the tendering stage has changed a lot, and clients tend to get the contractor involved much earlier on. So I had the amazing opportunity to work with incredible design studios, architects, but very early on, like stage three forward, and help them say, right, this is the vision, but how do we build it? How do we make it real? How do we realize your vision, your aesthetic, and actually translate that into building? So I had a lot of experience in that and kind of went from there. I think it's great that actually you can lean into anything, that it's a very, very worthy degree that can put you down any route. Mm-hmm. But the traditional sense of architecture is very different to interior design, as you picked up on. Yeah. That a lot of it is to do with, you know, structures, coordination, how everything stands up, how it all works, how the picture puzzle comes together. There's a lot of regulation. There's a lot of credentials that you have to achieve to do that. Whereas interiors is a lot more of the, you know, kind of the person and how they feel and the way the space comes together. But, you know, I think all the skills are transferable. I've got an amazing team of loads of fabulous interior designers, and they do loads of the great projects that we're responsible for. So they're worth a mention. But it's always funny when someone puts a drawing in front of me to have a look or to comment on, I can always tell who's drawn it. And I think that's really interesting. You say, I can tell straight away which one of the designers has done this floor plan or who's done this elevation or who's done this palette. And that's, I think, the fundamentals of the whole industry is having an identity and a personality and doing something slightly different. And they all have their own different style. And that's influenced by their education, their background. Some of them are architects, some aren't architects, some are engineers. And how they tackle a problem with that education is really interesting.
Wow. And I suppose that then helps you put them on the right projects, like as the creative director, like when a project comes in, like this is one for X and this is one for Y.
Absolutely.
Not to number your stuff.
No, 100%. That it's so true. And things come in and I sit there and I'm like, you know, I know these two are going to be fighting over this one. It's right up their street. Other people are like, oh, I'd rather not. That's not for me. And I think it's so important, you know, it's not about project comes in, client wants something, you do it on this day, submit it on that day. That's not how we operate. Mm-hmm. It's really trying to match up the right people with the right projects. We've got some members of the team who work with specific clients because mm-hmm. they've got an amazing relationship. They've done stuff before together. They like how each other works. And we try to match people accordingly. Some people are really interested in furniture. We've obviously, within the group of CAST, we've got CAST Living, mm-hmm. which does living asset, built to rent, large scale, interior kind of residential furniture. And we, in my team specifically, there's a few people who really love doing that. And it's just the diversity of what we do. So one day they'll be working on a large scale kind of base build construction project, another time they'll be working on fit out, then they'll be working on the residential furniture. And it's just nice to have that tapestry that it's not the same day in, day out.
Yeah.
Other people love doing the same types of things. So it's a big part of my role to make sure that they can excel and succeed in their careers is putting them on jobs that is going to inspire them and things that they're good at.
CAST Group is a design and build and construction furniture company, which is majority female led.
Yes.
Are you one of the founders?
Yes. Yeah. So myself and Zoe, and obviously our colleagues, Steve and that, but it is the majority share is owned by women, which is obviously a great accolade.
In the construction world.
In the construction world particularly, we are 36% female. And I think the industry average is about 14%. So that's incredible. It wasn't intentional, you know. Mm-hmm. It was just a bunch of people who love working together, who had big ideas, wanted to do something different. Mm-hmm. And we started the company and we happened to be women. But I think what it does is it gives us a competitive edge because of the creativity that breeds. not because we're women, but because having that really diverse team does the way we tackle problems and ideas, and the from an interior point of view, having that balance of how you respond to a brief or how things are done on site or anything along those lines, it really, we can feel the diversity and the kind of the tapestry of stuff that we churn out because of how many people in the company are from diverse
different backgrounds. Yeah. How do you actually be sustainable? Because a lot of people talk about it, but you've got actions that you actually take.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm going to preface this by saying that, you know, we're doing our best. And I say this to people all the time and they always look at me strange, go, it's a weird thing to say. But we do everything we can with the information that we've got right now. And I hope that in 3-4 years time, we look back and laugh and be like, do you remember how sustainable we thought we used to be like 5 years ago? And now what we do.
Yeah.
But actually, that's part of the journey. That's the process. Yeah. It's not like we're sustainable, a line in the sand and that's that. It's we are doing our absolute best right now. And if we can joke about how we are now in a few years time, well, you know, that's amazing. Because it means we've taken steps forward. But in the design and build process, I think it's quite unique in that you have full control of the process from concept, client, their goals, their aspirations through to delivery. So for us, it always starts with design and things down to, you know, what exactly is the brief? Sometimes you'll challenge the brief and say, why do you want to do that? Often they're going to strip out and start again. But you say, right, well, you've got 3 walls in places on this floor plan that we can make this work really well for you as a scheme without stripping it out and starting again. Things like when building, you know, walls, joinery, we delve into what size are the sheets. So if a sheet comes in 1200 wide and you want to do a 2.5 meter length of something, well, that's wastage. There's offcuts. You need 3 boards to do something that. So we will modularize everything so that we're getting the most efficient cuts. All of these things kind of filter through and build the bigger picture. Yes, products, that's great, and choosing these different things, but it's how the design as a whole can all these little elements feed into it. That's quite a big thing of what we do.
Transport as well.
Yeah, so we think you can't truly be sustainable if at the end of a project, where does your site setup go? Where do all of your materials go? Where does your packaging go? It's, of course, there's fantastic partners in the industry who can manage that for you. But from our point of view, we wanted to know everything about where our stuff was being stored, where it was going. So we've got out in Essex, we've got a warehouse, a yard that we consolidated. There's a beautiful office out there that lots of people work at. And for us, it's important that we know where things are coming and going. We can consolidate things. We do deliveries in batches. We don't do runs into town for no reason. So we can really control that process. Mm-hmm. It also means if we're doing a strip out or something for a client that's no longer required, we can keep it. So if they're saying, oh, get rid of those reception chairs, we can say, yeah, no problem. We'll take them back. We'll use them. We'll reupholster them. We'll design them into another project. We'll donate them. But it's really hard to do that if you've only got a beautiful small office in central London, right? So that's quite key to how we operate. So we started in January 2020 and it was in the news. It was abroad. It wasn't currently in the UK. It wasn't a real problem at that point. And so, yeah, we set up the company. We started in earnest. And then we got sent home. So we had a little small office with no windows, a very humble little office in a co-working space in the city. And 6 weeks later, we got sent home. And that was it. So it's crazy. There was a small moment of, oh, we've just started a business and now we don't know what's happening in the world. We don't know what's going on. But it was actually the best thing that ever happened to us. It gave us time to reflect. It gave us time to think about what we wanted to do. We weren't stressing about meeting clients or going for a breakfast or booking meetings and doing these things. It just became very organic and very natural. You know, there's connections we had in the industry, as everybody does. And we'd say, should we do a Zoom call, have a chat, talk about, you know, how's homeschooling going? How's your family? Just very casual conversations over Zoom. And that kind of really enabled us to pick where we were going, the direction. And we had lots of inquiries and tenders coming in during that process. So it was quite cathartic, actually. We'd speak all the time on Zoom, on the phone, had a great time, you know, did online quizzes like everybody did, and just tried to refine our vision and palette and design and what was our identity going to be, essentially. So that was kind of the start of it. And then as we came out of lockdown towards the summer, we had a few clients who, you know, let's face it, they gave us a shot. And that's a big part of it, that we go on this journey, but we have amazing clients who support us. And I think a lot of big businesses have goals in terms of social value, supporting SMEs, supporting female-owned companies. They have these visions, they've got these aspirations, but actually the governance and the paperwork sometimes can actually preclude any small growing business to actually be part of that, because they say, do you have 5 years accounts? No, we don't. We've only existed a month. Or we've only existed 3 years, or, you know, and it's about having that really transparent conversation and saying, we've got, as people, 10, 20, 25 years industry experience. We can do the job. It's just under this umbrella, we haven't. And it takes some people who really believe in you, who really want to work with you, who've potentially worked with you previously, or are like, no, our goal is to support these companies. We want to see what this journey is. We want to see how you could do something different to what we've experienced before. And so, you know, grateful for all those opportunities. And I guess we didn't do a bad job. So it started with small 50 grand, 200 grand, really modest projects, and then did a great job. And we got more opportunities as a portfolio group. People get to know who you are. Mm-hmm. We, you know, people contact us saying, we've seen your design on LinkedIn, or we've seen your photos on Instagram, or we've been around a building in Soho and we love the design. We asked the building manager who'd done it. And it kind of went from there. Picking the name, that was always, that's a personal favorite, you know, okay. Cast.
How?
You know, we were just trying to, we had a lot of rosé. We had had a few bottles of rosé. We were trying to come up with a nice idea of what we could do. And we quite like the name. It's the collective pronoun for a pair of falcon. So it's a cast of falcons. So, and a falcon is a symbol for kind of strength and femininity and that kind of stuff. So it just seemed to fit. We were just two birds drinking rosé, and, you know, now we've got a pink bird logo. But yeah, that's how it came from, a cast of falcons. So all of these interesting, you know, experiences, things that we did. The reality is the office is so important because it breeds culture and ideas and creativity. And yes, I'm a designer, but creativity has to take place in every business. If you're in finance, if you're in operations, if you're in tech, creativity is the fundamental to how businesses grow and develop. And you need to have a space where that is flourishes.
So when we're designing spaces, how can we be more considerate for mental health?
I think it's a great question. It's something that's very important and topical, and not that it's an on-trend topic. It's not. It's just becoming more acceptable to talk about, which is amazing. But I think we've got big steps to take. Mm-hmm. There's what's really great is that there's a lot of people who have that as part of their brief. And actually, these companies are recognizing that it's something that needs to take place. But I think mental health is such an umbrella term for so many different things about how people are feeling and reacting. And so we're not professionals, you know, who deal with this on a medical level, but it's about creating places that people feel safe to, first of all, most importantly, have the conversation. You know, if you've got formal meeting rooms with boardroom tables and chairs and big shiny flat screen TV, you might be less inclined to have a conversation with your line manager or a colleague or a friend, because it's just not the environment where you might have that chat. Mm-hmm. And so it's having places that are conducive to it, you know, where you can offer that bit of support. As a business, we've got loads of initiatives that tackle that. But that's definitely from kind of an employer point of view and initiatives of how we deal with that, asking questions. But that's more a behavioral thing, not a design focused thing. But having spaces, like neurodiverse spaces, we've got in our office rooms that you can go into that are quiet. You can dim the lights. You can put the blinds down. You can lift the blinds. We have meeting rooms that have sofas and armchairs in them, not tables. We have a room without, it doesn't have a glass door on the front. You know, there's so many different things, but I think first and foremost, it's about making people comfortable so they can have that conversation. And it's a personal thing. It's a human interaction thing. It's how you can help, how you can reach out. And from a workplace point of view, that starts with having somewhere that's safe and comfortable and being able to have that chat. Another thing which is quite interesting is the island, the kitchen island. I think the world revolves around the kitchen island, and it's almost like the conversation around having difficult, challenging conversations in the car. You know, when you were growing up and they had something bad to tell you, or you had something bad to tell them, or there was a difficult conversation to be had, that looking someone in the eye can be really challenging and difficult and hard to kind of say how you feel. So we really champion the kitchen island as somewhere that all of these conversations can take place, not necessarily in a public forum, but being able to sit beside someone or being able to talk whilst you turn around, make a cup of coffee and turn back. Or you might say something that's upsetting you or bothering you, or you might have to take a deep breath to say something particular to your friend, that you can go and open the fridge, that it's having this setup that enables people to have conversations that not necessarily in a really formal, formal way.
Like they say, you have the best conversations when you're going for a walk with someone, isn't it? Like you're side by side and you've got the walking, which is obviously releasing good endorphins anyway.
Yeah.
And makes people super comfortable and they're more open. And I think you're kind of creating that within an office, which is lovely.
Yeah. And a place where people can go. We're lucky, we've got an amazing roof terrace at the office and we've got an allotment. So that's something that's great, that we grow herbs, fruit, veg, all of that kind of stuff. We make lunch in the office every day for everybody. And in the summer, we use some of those herbs, those different things that we try our best to incorporate into the menu and the food and what we're serving on those particular days. You know, we grow mint. Sometimes there will be a mojito had on a Friday that we're trying to use from our gardens. But having places that are just different, you're sitting in the fresh air, you're in the sun, it gives you a different feeling. And that's very important, I think, for us to have that outdoor space, that fresh air. But as a problem, it's something that employers really need to consider.
Yeah.
But for me, it's about having the conversation and not being the silent, unspoken thing. And the only place you can have a conversation like that, that's challenging or someone's in a difficult place, is to have somewhere secure, safe, comfortable that they can have it in. So we always say we don't advocate for a formal reception desk. We kind of call it touchdown, concierge, reception bar, welcome bar, because what we've found is that from projects we worked on previously, the girl or guy who might be managing the reception desk, it's so isolating. It's such a lonely place to be. Often they're around a corner. Everyone they're engaging with might be a stranger. That sense of culture, having one person quite isolated from the rest of the team, is not something that we should be advocating for. You know, having somebody on their own all day in a certain place. So we try to tackle that in a different way, that there might be a bank of six desks where the front of house team members would be able to see the front door. They'd be able to access it. There'll be a nice bar, podium, somewhere that they can stand, check people in and out. Completely able to fulfill their role, but just feel more part of the team, that they're included. And having those lines of sight, I think, is really, really important, as well as having kind of nooks, smaller places and larger gathering space. That's something that we always try to look at.
That's really interesting. I must admit, I'd never considered a receptionist who could be a vulnerable person sitting on their own at the front of a building, on their own, and meeting strangers one after the other after the other.
Yeah, and there's strangers coming in, but also everybody who leaves, that often we're all in a rush, right? central London. We're all busy. Everyone's in a rush to go somewhere. And so it might be when you're leaving the office, you might be like, see you later, I'm off running out the door. And so the people you do know are brushing past you. And it's something that we don't enjoy. We don't do. We try to have that conversation with lots of people and nobody's ever resisted it, you know. Often challenges formalities around security, financial institutions. It's a role. You can't not have it.
Yeah.
But there's really clever ways in which you can fulfill the function,
yeah,
but have that person as part of the team.
Yeah.
But also have your guests arriving and feeling the culture, feeling part of the team.
Yeah.
That it's not you're sat there and then you're rushed into a room and the door is closed.
Mm-hmm.
These are people who are engaging with your business, you know, whether they're somebody coming for an interview, whether it's a client, that they are there to see what your business is doing, how they experience you.
Mm-hmm.
And so the front of house, back of house thing, I don't think there's a need for it.
No.
I think being visible, being transparent should be seen.
When I see a welcome bar, I'll think of you.
There you go.
And I also hope I get a drink at the welcome
yes,
bar.
Yes, absolutely.
Like a champagne on arrival.
We could arrange that.
When we're buying furniture, there is truly timeless pieces that don't date.
Yeah.
That we can use and we can incorporate into designs. Like you say, they last 20 years and they shouldn't need any change, if you like. They can just be as they are.
As they are.
Mm.
Yeah. So there's loads of different degrees to it. You know, there's things that we do a really great deep clean on, steam them, any touch-ups required. And then it goes back in the way it just looks the exact same. Then you've got reupholstering, which is quite simple, leaving the frame the way it is. It's reupholstering and changing the colour of the frame. And then there's restuffing. So, you know, if there's something that visibly you've had some large arses in over the years and it's got a dint in it, you can repad it, change it,
mm-hmm,
make it look new. So there's loads of different levels of intervention. And then there's just things that you know they're visibly not new, but it's a nice piece of furniture,
mm-hmm,
and it's perfect for the scheme.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a story behind it. It's eclectic. There's no harm in that either. But I don't think we'll never be out of the requirement for new furniture, you know. And so this isn't that nobody should buy anything new. That's not how it is. We've had really positive conversations with loads of UK furniture manufacturers. And people seem quite positive about this because actually it's an amazing accolade for them that we'll always need new, but it's having that badge of our product is so well made, it's so sustainable, it's so well put together, it's stylish, it's unique, that our product can be remanufactured. That's a really big selling point. So you might buy something and you might pay a premium for it being made in the UK or made a certain way. But actually, if you can use that product for the next 20 years in different guises, spend the money.
Mm-hmm.
You could buy something that can't be reupholstered, is not made very well, has a 2-year warranty,
mm-hmm,
and you might buy that chair 10 times over, which ends up more expensive. So it's thinking a lot more longer term.
Mm-hmm.
It is something that we need to get our heads around. And for it to be a collaboration with old and new. And again, I said fashion will never go. There will always be the requirement for a new design, a new chair, a new product, a launch of something interesting. But for everything that exists, keep it in circulation.